Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to a special presentation, an in-depth investigative report on AIDS, A Second Opinion, Deconstructing Its Myths. For those of you who've had an opportunity to hear the previous programs I've done in this series, this is program number 13, and I'm taking this to the level of explaining why we should look carefully at the facts and look at the facts of the origin of AIDS. We claim that it was in Africa. We claim that it was in Haiti. We claim that it was there because of their sexual promiscuity, and therefore could not help themselves. Therefore, we must intervene. But what if everything that we've been taught about AIDS in Africa were wrong? Let us examine some of the history of the evolving idea, hypothesis, that it is in Africa. And in this hour of the program, I'm going to dissect step by step the story behind the story, the one that the media has recklessly and irresponsibly not presented. All of the facts that I am sharing, all the footnotes of these facts and the scientific references for them can be found on my webpage, GaryNull.com. When in 1982 Haitians were diagnosed with AIDS, the yet as unidentified infectious agent was immediately assumed to come from that country. A Haitian origin soon fell into disfavor, at least in part because no evidence could be found that AIDS existed in Haiti prior to its appearance in the United States, and was soon superseded by the African hypothesis, with or without the rider that the virus had stopped over in Haiti en route to the United States. The African origin of AIDS was immediately accepted in the West with minimal critical assessment, and there was significant debate only on the issues of whether the reservoir of HIV was in a remote tribe of Africans or in African monkeys, or at what point it spread from Africa to the West was uncertain. We must elucidate the nexus between readiness to believe in the black source and an unacknowledged racist bias. As Europe began to come to terms with the Nazi Holocaust, racism lost much of its intellectual respectability, a process hastened by independence in the colonies and the black civil rights movement in the United States. But whilst the expression of racism may be less acceptable, the underlying racist beliefs, particularly those pertaining to Africans individually, remained integrated into the European and American worldview. Thus, within the scientific literature about AIDS in Africa, all the racist themes can be found underpinning arguments for which scientific evidence is contradictory or absent. Africans are primitive peoples living in isolated tribes cut off from civilization, so could have harbored diseases for centuries before they spread it to the rest of the world. They are evolutionary closer to monkeys, thus could be more readily acquiring monkey diseases, perhaps by having sexual relations with monkeys, or at least involving them in their sexual practices. They are sexually unrestrained, and a sexually transmitted disease would therefore spread more readily amongst them than any other group, and their objections to being attributed with this source are harmful to themselves and do not need to be taken seriously. That's just one view. But that, unfortunately, extremely racist view was widely held by many people within the scientific community, and as a result parroted like lapdogs too eager to please their masters by mainstream media journalists. In the last extended quote, Harrison Chermuta has raised a point already familiar with our discussion of Miller's work, namely the myth that Africans are sexually unrestrained, as well as adding a point we will consider later in our program, which is that African health workers are seldom consulted on what's going on their continent. Turns out that African doctors and other health workers, who one might think should be given special credence since they are literally at the scene of the crime, are the ones whose opinions seem to be given the least weight by Western researchers. Before tackling that topic, let's look a little further at this racist idea of African hypersexuality. Chiramuta links the willingness of Western scientists to give immediate credence to the idea that there has been a speedy spread of HIV through Middle and Southern Africa to stereotypes about African sensuality. They say, Africans were said to indulge in anal intercourse and intercourse during menstruation and were far more promiscuous than other people. Well, this belief in African overindulgence has become a caricature. He argues, if claims that a third of sexually active adults in some African central countries are infected with AIDS are true, life in these countries must be one of an endless orgy. Guided by prejudice, Westerners were quick to jump to conclusions about the African origin and ready transmission of the disease. Given the racist stereotyping of black people as dirty, disease-carrying, sexually promiscuous individuals, it was virtually inevitable that black people, on the first sighting of the disease amongst them, would be attributed to its source. So as soon as a few Haitians were seen to harbor the disease, the gay plague changed overnight to the Haitian disease, even though, as mentioned, attempts to lay the disease at the door of the Caribbean natives didn't pan out. Chiramuta explains, the idea of black people as the source of AIDS was too attractive to abandon. Attention shifted to the African continent itself. His conclusions, racism, not science, motivated the search for the origins of AIDS. Dr. Charles Geschechter, a professor of African studies, by the way, has noted that not only is the idea of African indulgence a myth without any foundation in reality, but if we compare the incidence of sexual promiscuity in the southern part of Africa with, say, its incidence in the U.S., our country comes across as very much the loser. If the winner is the society where a restrained morality is practiced. According to Geschechter, who has been to Africa many times and has spent a great deal of effort interviewing people about their traditions and their customs, then listen carefully, because the myth of African immorality can be dated back to quite a few ways. Early European travelers returned from Africa bringing tales of black men allegedly performing carnal athletic feats with black women who were themselves sexually insatiable. He goes on, the reality, however, is very different from our perceptions. Widespread modesty codes for women whose sexuality is considered a gift to be used for procreation make many African societies seem chaste compared to West. The Somalis, the Eras, the Oromos, the Amaras of northeastern Africa think that public displays of sexual feelings demean a woman's gift so that sexual contacts are restricted to ceremonial touching or dancing. Beginning sexual relationships are geared to the beginnings of making a family. The notion of boyfriends and girlfriends, virtually universal in the West, has no parallel in most traditional African cultures. Now, we might note in passing that another myth dredged up from all this by Chiramuta, that Africans have much contact with monkeys and so might have caught AIDS from a simian virus, is worth about as much credence as the myth of Africans' unrestrained sexuality. Geschechter notes, most Africans have little or no contact with monkeys, and amongst those who regularly hunt monkeys, for example, the pygmies of the equatorial rainforest, AIDS is notable for its absence. Moreover, the claim that the disease originated by jumping species from ape to man could be used as a textbook example of bad science. First, ideas that the SV40 virus, a virus that was found in monkeys, was similar to a virus isolated from a West African prostitute, were disproved by the SIV was found to be a laboratory contaminant. But that never made the news. Then it was hazarded that SIV mutated into HIV in the last few decades. The conclusion based upon estimates of the rate of mutation of these viruses and their degree of genetic dissimilarity. even those uninitiated in scientific mysteries can see that this is a flight of fancy. One might as well compare the virus that causes the common cold with HIV. Note how much they differ. They count up the number of mutations it would take for the former to mutate into the latter, taking that of evidence that the cold was the origin of AIDS. Besides, Cermuto writes, even if such an improbable event, the mutations did occur, given the existing colonial ties and trading links between Africa and Europe, the virus would have caused an epidemic in Europe at the same time as before the epidemic in the United States. Yet taking only the Western countries, evidence points to the U.S. preceding Europe as a center of infection. Now, it's worth making the further point that the enterprise of installing AIDS in Africa has even been given a sentimental panthea in a spurious tracing of the first European victim struck down by the African plague. According to Cermutis, one of the most cited papers in support of an African origin of AIDS, AIDS in a Danish Surgeon, Zaire, in 1976, which described the case of a surgeon, Dr. Rask, who had supposedly caught HIV from her patient while working in a hospital in Ecuador province. One reason this paper is so relied upon is that it was incorporated into the best-selling book by Randy Schultz and The Band Played On about the AIDS epidemic, where the story was told in a crowd-pleasing way with the use of inflated rhetoric. After noting that Schultz labels Rask as, quote, Danish surgeon in Zaire, first Western documented to have died of AIDS, unquote. Well, look at what was really known about the Rask death. A British researcher, Dr. Janie Grote, wrote in a scientific paper about the Danish surgeon inquiring further about Dr. Rask and received the following reply. We have found a very small serum sample, which was taken shortly before the patient died in 1977. And we knew already that it was HIV ELISA antibody negative. Thus, we cannot prove that the patient had AIDS, although the clinical picture was very suggestive. Unquote. Now, here's the point. When you look at Randy Schultz, he has been elevated to a godlike status for his book, The Blame Paid On, but he was wrong. Quite simply, a lot of what he said was wrong. But we don't want to touch our gods. That will disturb a lot of the psyches. We have our heroes in place. Don't let things like facts get in the way of telling a good story. The fact is that the so-called first person in Africa that proved to die of AIDS didn't have AIDS, didn't have HIV, and even the scientists who did the original autopsy showed that. But no one wanted that story. We wanted The Band Played On. Quote, we have found very small serum sample which was taken shortly before the patient died, and we know already that it was HIV ELISA antibody negative. Thus, we cannot prove that the patient had AIDS, although the clinical picture was very suggestive, unquote. I repeated that twice just so that this famous AIDS case should be known to everyone that it was seronegative. This information was not, of course, presented to the world, and that's unfortunate. We need to say a little more about the Schultz book, which does include valuable, hard-hitting information, which I believe that people could benefit from, even though many of his statements are simply wrong. In his brief sections on Africa, he falls flat. In fact, in these parts, the vulgarization, sensationalism, and yes, fictionalization of the AIDS crisis in Africa reaches a kind of giddy height. Although Schultz is powerfully compassionate when treating gay males and drug users in the U.S., when he moves to Africa, it's time to trot out the stereotypes, not only of the pathetic blacks, but of the great white virus hunters who appear on the scene to selflessly battle for their well-being. My collaborator in my research of the last year has drawn my attention to how Rask is depicted as a headstrong heroine who decides to work in Africa despite the fact that, quote, a surgeon work has risks that doctors in the developing world could not imagine. such as lack of adequate supplies and greater danger of infection from patients, which places Zaire on the frontiers of the world's harshest medical realities. Rask is up to the task, however, because of her strong Anglo-Saxon racial heritage. I'm quoting now from Randy Schultz. She grew up in the northern part of her native land, far from the kings of Copenhagen. These hardy northern people had nurtured their collective heritage, which made them direct and decisive, independent and plain-spoken. Okay. It is such qualities which the Africans apparently lack, at least so as to appear from their reaction to the Ebola disease, which Rask had earlier witnessed in her area. Frightened African health officials swallowed their pride and called the Western World Health Organization. It's no wonder they couldn't handle it on their own, given the irrationality of your common African. Quote, natives were infuriated with the Americans brought in to clean up the African mess, banned the traditional burials of the victims since the ritual bathing of the bodies was clearly spreading the disease further. Let's stand back a minute. I'm not saying that anything here didn't happen, that the World Health Organization wasn't called in or the natives become recalcitrant, but that details are selected to build on stereotypes. Schultz does not mention Africans doing anything positive to help the World Health Organization, only the fact that they are willing to block efforts. He even tries to get in the promiscuity angle by adding about the first carrier of the disease, quote, the man apparently had picked up the disease sexually, unquote. Not only that, as if to rivet the idea that one's relation to disease is linked to racial heritage, Schultz cites an unnamed historian to vaunt the following far-fetched idea, quote, one historian has suggested that humans, who first evolved in Africa eons ago, migrated north to Asia and Europe simply to get to climates that were less hospitable to the deadly microbes the tropics so effectively bred. Is it too much to read this as hinting the enterprising Asians and Europeans moved to climates where they could become, quote, direct and decisive, independent and plain-spoken? As he says, while their more shiftless cousins roosted in the same spot? That last point may be an exaggerated interpretation, but it is was no exaggeration to use the term fictionalization for his book. Although Band is about real events, using the literary precedent of the 1960s New Journalism, which borrowed from fictional techniques to jazz up reporting, it goes into the minds of the leading characters as if Schultz were an omniscient narrator, privy to everything anyone thought. Whatever value such liberty may be making the book more readable, one notable effect it does have is helping the self-aggrandizement of Western medicine. It's very reassuring for readers to be able to see into the minds of doctors to learn how selfless and dedicated they are. For instance, when Dr. Bybeard, the physician who wrote the cited paper on Rask, finds out about her death, they were close friends, Schultz reveals his torment, quote, Bisberg would never forgive himself for taking her away from the cottage north of the ford. He had brought her to the city for tests, and she died in the hospital. Well, Bisberg decided he would devote his life to studying tropical medicine. He wanted to know what microscopic marauder had come from the African jungles to so ruthlessly rob the life of his best friend, a woman who had been so intensely devoted to helping others. Unquote. If the reader can get past the purple prose, perhaps it will be evident that Schultz is implicitly drawing a contrast with the passage about how Africans react to death that appeared three pages before in the book. While Africans are irrationally demanding to wash their dead, irrationally demanding physical contact with the corpses, a Westerner, by contrast, has a purely intellectual connection with the deceased best friend. Rather than allowing himself idle tears, he pledges himself to the pursuit of truth in her name. By no means am I suggesting that Schultz is a racist, but rather that he is thoughtlessly picking up the stereotypes about Africa that are all too ready to hand in to people in the popular and serious Western culture. There is one last thing to say in this discussion. Although our main concern is that part of the study in Africa, least we think that an implicit racism can only be found in AIDS thinking that centers on that continent. It'll be enlightening to look for a moment at how this racism can also extend to the coverage of blacks in the United States. To just take one example, witness an editorial that appeared on May 12, 1992 in the New York Times and was titled, "The AIDS Plot Against Blacks." The piece began, "Bizarre as it may seem to most people, many black Americans believe that AIDS and the health measures used against it are part of a conspiracy to wipe out the black race." Note the polite language, absolutely du jour. Not nowadays to put racist ideas into circulation in our touchy environment. The writer doesn't say the notion is bizarre, but that it may seem bizarre. Nor does the author say everyone will find it bizarre, only most, yet the beliefs being discussed are made to seem as nonsensical as if they had been rejected outright. Imagine if one were to say this: irrational as it may seem to most, Duisberg believes there is a conspiracy to prove HIV causes AIDS. Note the italicized word conspiracy. Using this word in connection with an opinion is another not-so-subtle indicator that such opinion is held by a kook, since conspiracy is a delusional belief that world events are secretly controlled by a cabal of behind-the-scenes operators. And we know that no American media believes in conspiracies. Unless, of course, it's a terrorist conspiracy. But our government? Never. Scientists? Never. Pharmaceutical industries? Never. Special interest groups? Never. No, that doesn't happen. We don't have conspiracies. Our hands are clean of those. Let's go a little further into this article. But this time, I will highlight such indicator words that are thrown into seemingly objective discussion in order to slant opinion in a way selected by the author. The listener can work out how these words work on prejudice for themselves. I'll quote the New York Times. "A survey of black church members in 1990 found that an astonishing 35% believed AIDS was a form of genocide. A poll found that one black in 10 believes that the AIDS virus was deliberately created in a laboratory in order to infect black people. Worse yet, the treatments and preventatives against AIDS have become suspect. Some blacks believe that AZT is a plot to poison them." Unquote. Nina Ostrom has written some eloquent words on the overall racism found in this editorial. However, for me, the key point is the note hit on AZT. As we will see in a later part of my series, there is widespread dissent about AZT being an adequate prophylactic among health workers of all races. The Times article, then, does double duty for the establishment. On the one hand, serving its racial prejudices by indicating how weak-minded African Americans are in that they prefer dubious emotional responses to the AIDS crisis rather than proper scientific ones. And on the other hand, serving the establishment's scientific prejudices by suggesting that dissenting views of the utility of AZT are confined to groups that are scientifically marginal. However, for all these brave words, there are flaws in the AZT thesis that are just flaws in the connections generally made between AIDS and Africa. Let's turn to some of them. Let's look at weaknesses of the African thesis. Facts clash with received opinions. The orthodoxy's opinions on how Africa and AIDS are connected might be said to involve even more than the usual effrontery. While establishment ideas about the existence of HIV and the fact that HIV causes AIDS, for example, have a surface plausibility, notions about the African genesis and the spread of the disease seem to involve a glaring contradiction. or at least conflict in their base premises. Think about this. Orthodoxy holds the following two concepts. One, AIDS originated in Africa from whence it spread to the West, and two, African AIDS, which affects mainly heterosexuals, is fundamentally different from AIDS as it appears in the West. Am I the only one who smells fish when he hears that these two ideas proclaimed in tandem? Diseases are found in two different regions of the world, which have significant differences, yet it is confidently asserted that they are the same disease. That perhaps one could swallow, but what about the point that one in one region is the origin of the two? The other found in another region is a copy. But diseases do not, like passports, get stamped at customs and transform themselves as they travel across national borders. Even if we accept the idea that HIV is very apt to mutate into new forms, how can it be explained that every HIV strain that has been carried from Africa to, say, the U.S. undergoes the same type of transformation, moving from a disease that is homosexuality transmitted to one that has been heterosexually passed? Such an idea begs belief. Well, Dr. Papadopoulos Eliopoulos and her group of scientists in Perth, Australia, have challenged this. She says, if AIDS in Africa is the same condition with the same cause as anywhere else in the world, then AIDS in Africa and AIDS in the West should be identical. This is not the case, and what is called AIDS in Africa is almost unrecognizably different from AIDS in the West, so much so that if African patients suddenly switched continents, very few Africans would remain AIDS cases. This is due to the existence of multiple AIDS definitions. There's a tortured way of dealing with this discrepancy. The one chosen by Orthodoxy, which holds a mutant strain started the disease in the U.S. and Europe, and a common-sense way to handle it. Understand that these are different diseases. Before grappling with this problem, let's note some of the less startling contradictions that have to be appended to the African AIDS thesis, ones that have moved many health workers to doubt the underpinnings of these concepts. For one thing, we may measure the exaggeration in the statistics generally reported from the continent, which have often proved as fallacious as those used to be issued about heterosexual transmission in the West that was expected to rocket skyward as soon as HIV was passed beyond the original high-risk groups. African statistics have been overblown both in terms of overall projections of spread and of the lethalness for the future and in current assessments, which, as we saw in a previous program, were often based upon presumptive diagnosis and unreliable tests for HIV positivity. However, even if, for the sake of this argument, we accept the large number of cases of HIV infection recorded by Orthodoxy in Africa, we find that having HIV does not translate to getting AIDS as readily as it does in the West. Here, I suppose, is another firm difference between African and Western HIV, i.e., in Africa, one doesn't die of infection, or at least not at the same rate as in the West. This is not a difference that is made much of, especially in comparison to the difference in sexual contact and number of sexual partners that one has in Africa. Remember, you do not have that high sexual transmission rate, since it goes against the grain of the hyped up fears of an African epidemic. According to Celia Farber, once HIV was detected in Africa, the media was pouring out reports of a continent on the brink of virtual extinction. She goes on that in the eyes of mainstream reporters, there was no question. AIDS was bulldozing Africa, taking out entire villages, men, women, and children, changing the demographics of Central Africa forever. Yet these forebodings were based upon the idea that HIV would be as quickly lethal in Africa as it was in the West. Now, if AIDS truly originated on the continent, it should even be more lethal in that cases there would have had more time to pass the incubation period. Farber notes, according to official sources such as those from the World Health Organization, 7 million Central Africans are infected with HIV. In comparison terms, worldwide, 69% of HIV-positive people are in Africa, while only 16% in the United States. However, in terms of actual reported AIDS cases, 44% come from the United States, whereas only 30% come from Africa. This adds up to 230,179 people with AIDS in the United States and 151,000 people in Africa as of 1993. That just doesn't get attention. Now keep in mind, for those of you who are just joining us, I'm Gary Nall, talking about dispelling the myths of AIDS. You are probably of the opinion or belief that when we talk about AIDS in Africa, it's because someone has gone to a village, taken at least two and probably three blood chemistries, and shown that a person was seropositive and had certain indicator infections, and therefore was given the proper diagnosis of being HIV infected or with AIDS. Not true. It is called a presumptive diagnosis. What they will do is they will contact a field hospital and say, how many people there that you're seeing have an unproductive dry cough, are wasting, losing weight at a certain percentage, or have a chronic infection or diarrhea? And the person says, oh, 80% of the people, 80% of the people then have AIDS or HIV infected and have AIDS. How many people are sick? Oh, we have a lot of people who are sick here. Mm-hmm. Okay, then they have full-blown AIDS. And they died? Yes, some of them died, but then they died of AIDS. That is as bad as science can get. It is a total and complete perversion of anything that is based upon fact. Because what symptoms do you have if you have malaria? Well, you have a non-productive dry cough, you'll waste, you'll have diarrhea, you'll have local infections, you'll have thrush, you have dementia. I see. What if you have tuberculosis? Well, you have a non-productive dry cough, and you'll have wasting, you have diarrhea, you have local infections. What if you're starving to death, as over 65 million Africans are doing daily? Or you have a non-productive dry cough, you'll be wasting away, and you have diarrhea and bloating and local infections. What if you have fevers that you picked up from drinking contaminated water? Oh, you'll have non-productive dry cough, you'll be wasting. So in other words, there's a whole lot of diseases that are endemic right now and have been in Africa because of civil wars, because of conflicts with no infrastructure in many of the countries. And people simply don't have enough food to eat, clean water to drink. They're susceptible to infections and to malaria. But do we have anti-malarial programs? No. How about anti-tubercular programs? No, no money for that. When I spoke with the Minister of Health for Uganda, and when I spoke with other health officials in Africa, they said there was no money available for those, only a token amount, but there was a lot of money available for AIDS. Well, what do you do when someone is sick? Well, there's nothing we can do except some of the French and the missionaries and the French physicians would take the children from parents who said that my child has AIDS and take them in and feed them. And miraculously, these children, after about 2 months, no longer had AIDS. They no longer had infections. They were eating adequate amounts of nutrition, drinking clean water, and living in a non-stigmatized environment. And then it occurred to some of these missionaries that maybe the kids were being dropped off because the parents couldn't afford to feed them. And if they said, my child is starving, the missionaries would say, but we have millions of people starving, and we can't help you. But if you say, my child has AIDS, then there is room, another mouth table. Any American journalists write about it? No. Any American scientists? No. Anyone from the CDC ever go there to see this? Not a person. Anyone from the World Health Organization aware of this? Absolutely not. How is it possible that everybody has overlooked this? But they have. They have all overlooked the basics. what would happen if we had 1/4 of the American population suffering from the casualties of civil war, dysentery, cholera, gross malnutrition, gross caloric deficiency? Would we then, just on presumptive diagnosis of symptoms, be able to classify them as having AIDS? No, we'd say they don't have AIDS, they have these diseases of malnutrition or infection. But in Africa, we're saying they have AIDS. Have we done blood workups on all these people? No, on less than 1% of the population. Well, here's an interesting thing. What if you have malaria and you have an HIV antibody test? There's a high probability you're going to test positive simply because you have malaria. It cross-reacts with the antibodies. So what that means in just basic lay language is that if you did have a blood chemistry test and you did have cholera or tuberculosis or malaria, you would probably test positive even if you did not have the virus. The damaging part of that is that you would then be given now an antiretroviral drug that could fully destroy your immune system and cause death. That would then increase the statistics of how many people are dying of AIDS in Africa. No, they were dying of malnutrition, exacerbated by the fact that they were given toxic drugs. But that scenario won't help the pharmaceutical industry push forward through the last administration, probably this administration. Let's help Africans, let's have mandatory testing, and let's give them all drugs. You got to connect the dots to see how it all comes together. Give you an example from Chermutis notes the following findings about infection not leading to the disease that come from field studies of a particular country, Kenya. He mentions findings which emerged from a study conducted in Kenya by 12 researchers, including Dr. Robert Bigger and Dr. Robert Gallo. Researchers came up with high figures for HIV infection. Overall, 21% of the population studied were seropositive, but in one ethnic group, the Turkana, 50% were positive. Still, there were no cases of AIDS. Other studies have yielded the same results, rampant infection, but almost no illness. It is an understatement by the author when he concludes it is unlikely that AIDS illnesses of the recognized varieties are occurring at a rate commensurate with the prevalence of antibody against HTLV-3. The antibody's presence, as we have seen, being the recognized way to establish the existence of HIV in a patient. A broader scale report, which covered 1984 to 1995, was published by the World Health Organization's weekly epidemiological reports. It showed that 97% of those who test HIV positive in Africa don't have AIDS. I might mention, until they're given anti-AIDS drugs, and that also could be said true here in the United States. Go back for a moment. Go back to when I was reporting on the scene and as a scientist and as a public health scientist, I like to go in and not just accept what some other writer or journalist or scientist has suggested. I want to see for myself, because I have seen so many times with bias in people's reporting or misrepresenting the facts. And so I would look at people who had tested to see if they had the so-called virus that will cause AIDS, and they came back with a positive antibody test. Now, some of those individuals did not take the drugs, at that time 600 milligrams of AZT a day, which is extremely dangerous and lethal, and others did. Now, I remember when I was debating a group of pro-AZT scientists at New York University, and I was the only person on the panel who held these views. And what was of interest to me is the audience, primarily gays, were really supportive of the doctrines by these mainstream scientists, saying, yes, you must test positive. If you get the HIV antibody test, this means you're going to get AIDS, but put time on your side. That was the first time I heard that statement. Put time on your side. Take AZT early. Take it frequently. I remember people told me that they were having their caregivers wake them up in the middle of the night so that they'd make sure that every 4 hours they had their AZT. After the lecture, a group came over to me of five individuals who did not know why they tested positive, because they didn't feel that they had things in their life that would have contributed to the risk. And at that time, I did not know that simple things like the flu, herpes, things that are so common could give you a false positive test. And they had not been retested. But they decided they wanted to try to beat this disease, beat this virus using natural techniques. All of those people that I followed remained healthy, and none of them succumbed. None of them went on to develop what we call AIDS. But overall, the ones that I interviewed who believed that they had to put time on their side by taking AZT, the drug that fights AIDS, all of those people died. Now, at one point, I began to look carefully and think, well, how is it that one group didn't take the drug and are alive and well, another group took the drug and are all dead? I couldn't get anyone to take a look at those statistics. I couldn't get anyone in the media or in the scientific community to recognize that we may have been causing AIDS by the drug and then other drugs that were given. It was just nobody wanted to accept that. And so what we may be seeing in Africa are cross-reactions to common things like malaria, which, mind you, if you have antibodies to malaria, you may have had malaria 30 years ago and be okay today, but you'll test positive. As long as you remain doing what you've been doing, there's a high probability you'll survive and lead a relatively normal life, unless you have many cofactors like malnutrition. But what has saved Africa from the high incidence of seroconversion into full-blown AIDS and death is they have not had the availability because they couldn't afford the drugs. Now they can. Now, through the good graces of the Clinton administration wanting to make sure that everybody has a drug, now they'll all have those drugs available to them. In fact, we've kind of tied in, you must take the drugs or we'll have trade sanctions against your country and punish you. Once again, the pharmaceutical industry wins. And where's the American media on this? Silent. Where's the American scientific community? Silent. Does anybody really care? Who wants to stand up to the pharmaceutical industry? Who wants to stand up to the power of the White House? Who wants to stand up to the World Health Organization? Not many people, as it turns out. A broader scale report, which covered 1984 and 1995, was published by the World Health Organization. And once again, 97% of those who showed tested positive for HIV did not have AIDS. I bring you back to the idea that that it's only when you start using the pharmaceuticals you start seeing the high incidence. Everything said thus so far in this section of my report about HIV positivity, however, has been accepting of the legitimacy of the establishment's measures based upon blood tests, ones which we already know are extremely fallible. When more accurate tests have been conducted, it has often been seen that HIV infection in Africa has been grossly overstated due to reliance on untrustworthy testing. A study done in Germany and published in the British Medical Journal found that about 10% of serum samples were positive with the ELISA test, the one commonly used, but only 0.07 were positive with the more specific testing. That is to say, one out of 143 positive ELISA tests was accurate. If such figures were to be projected, one would find that estimates of the incidence of AIDS virus infection in Central Africa were exaggerated by a factor of 150. To find the real size of the epidemic, one would have to take current orthodox figures and divide by 150. Now, would you have thought that this would have been the case? Has anyone done this? This study was focused on older blood samples, ones collected from 1976 to 1984, in order to both consider if HIV was as widespread as claimed and as importantly, as a way to partially test the hypothesis that AIDS originated in Africa. If it did, then there should have been early evidence of seropositivity in the countries from which it supposedly sprang. The Germans were wide-ranging in their sampling and examined blood from 6,015 people, including 789 from Senegal, Liberia, Ivory Coast, Burkina Faso, Nigeria, Gabon, Zaire, Uganda, and Kenya. The researchers discovered only four samples contained antibodies. Three of these were from Senegal. Their conclusion was fewer than 1 in 1,000 subjects were seropositive for AIDS at the time of sampling before 1985, which proved lower than the positivity found in German blood samples for the same time period, and do not support the hypothesis of the disease originating in Africa, unquote. Let me repeat this again so you understand it. Their conclusion was, quote, fewer than 1 in 1,000 subjects were seropositive for AIDS at the time of the sampling before 1985, which proved lower than the positivity found in the average German population for the same period, and do not support the hypothesis of the disease originating in Africa, unquote. Well, then why is it so many Americans still believe that AIDS originated in Africa? Scientists, journalists, front page covers. Well, let's take a look at that in some depth. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us in our special report on AIDS.